You're listening to Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty.
Brian Turner is an award-winning poet. He's formerly an infantry team leader in the United States Army in Iraq. He's published two collections of poetry, Hair Bullet and Phantom Noise, and now a memoir, My Life as a Foreign Country. Brian Turner, welcome to Intersection.
Thanks for having me on the show.
And there's a moment early in your memoir where you describe being on the verge of opening fire on a group of military contractors in Iraq. I'm just wondering, you know, why that moment kind of stuck out? What made you want to write about that?
I think partly because it was the first day, right, when we'd crossed the border. We'd crossed what you call the line of departure and then went from Kuwait into Iraq. This was in 2003, but it wasn't during the initial invasion. We were among the first wave to replace the invasion group. So it was the 3rd of December, 2003. It was early in the morning. We crossed the border. My squad leader was up in the hatch, and this brigade had several hundred vehicles. So we were in the very front vehicle of the entire convoy. And I remember we'd been told ahead of time, because there was no front line. There was no uniforms that would identify those we were fighting against. You know, so who is it that I need to worry about? What do they look like? I don't know. It's my first time to ever be in country. And we were told that if we saw an AK-47, to shoot it. That was the meme that went around that everybody had to, and we got, it was memorized and sort of drummed in the brain. See an AK-47, shoot it. So as we're driving up, I replaced my squad leader up in the front hatch. So now I'm in the front. I have a helmet on, so there's an intercom inside the vehicle. I'm looking ahead. I see a civilian car on the left shoulder of the road parked, and four guys walking perpendicular to the road on the right side towards their car, the way soldiers might walk. And each of them had an AK-47 on the far side of their body that they were trying to hide behind their far leg. And they were trying to huff it over to the car. I find myself in this position, my first few hours in Iraq, where I'm looking through the sights of my weapon and I'm about to pull the trigger. There's a fraction of a second I was going to do it. I used to teach rifle marksmanship. But then Parazu, the vehicle commander who was watching through a sight on the weapon system of the vehicle, he yelled out, "Badge." And that's what saved the man's life, not me.
And when you say badge, they were wearing some kind of identification?
Right. There were four of them, and the gentleman to the left was very smart and very quick thinking. He sort of turned his body because there was a badge that was hanging around his neck on his chest. And Parazu saw, I saw something shiny to the left, but I was leaning in to shoot the guy that was to his right. You know, I can close my eyes and picture myself. It feels like I can put myself very clearly and squarely in pretty much any day that I was in Iraq. And I think part of it is because I felt like it was one of those rare moments in my life where the past and the present, I mean, and right now the past, the present, and the future commingle, and they sort of jumble with each other. I'm thinking about getting my car fixed. I'm here with you in the studio, and the things maybe I said to somebody last week that I'd like to, I'll send them an email to talk about that or whatever. But when I was in Iraq, the past and the future sort of sloughed away, and I felt very much in the now. So much so that it made me feel very distant. America almost didn't exist. The soldier's job mirrors the writer's job, which is to pay attention to details. That was a phrase we even said soldier to soldier, was pay attention to the details, because the details can kill you if you don't pay attention to them. And with a writer, you know, the intensity isn't the same, but on the page, the details matter. They make all the difference.
Growing up, you described digging foxholes in the High Sierras wearing your dad's old National Guard uniform. How old were you in that moment?
Yeah, I was probably 12, I think. 12, maybe 13, mm-hmm. maybe 11, somewhere right around there. It was around 1977, 78, around there. And my dad had infantry manuals, so I could take the manuals and open them up. And I was mostly kind of a latchkey kid. My parents had multiple jobs, that kind of thing, so I was left to my own devices and had a shovel and a lot of dirt, and we lived down the country. So I was very interested in military history. And when I was 7 years old, my first job, I wanted to be an historian, as I looked for. And then I switched to Major League Baseball player. But, you know, initially it was history. And that's remained a thread throughout my life in terms of interest. So I'm out there digging holes. You know, I followed as best I could what it said in the manuals, grenade sumps, and try to get sectors of fire, fields of fire. So I was already learning the trade when I was a boy, but it was trying to emulate the uniforms that were hanging in my father's closet.
When did you decide you wanted to join the Army?
I almost joined the Marine Corps, so the military service was really part of my I guess when I was about 19. I almost joined the Marine Corps twice that year. I went down and took the tests and all that, and I found that they told me that I'd maxed out, you know. And I remember thinking it wasn't true. They were just pulling my leg. Because I remember thinking, okay, maybe on a good day, if I've had my orange juice or something, my verbal acuity, maybe I just get lucky, you know? But my mechanical aptitude, not a chance. You know, I was also at the time I was in a band. I had hair halfway down my back and wore a little skeleton earring, played bass guitar. And I thought, I'm going to finish college. And then that just led to another college and some more time. And then when I was about 30, I remember thinking, I knew the cutoff was 32. So I remember thinking, oh, I'm going to miss it. And then I joined. I wish I could go back to that guy, that version of me, and say, what exactly do you think you're going to miss? Because I had a lot to learn.
Do you regret joining the Army? Do you regret signing up?
That seems like a natural extension of the conversation, right where, you know, it was leading. But I try not to think in terms of regret. I just try to think, okay, here's the life I've lived. Like, what can I do with this experience, these experiences to help me evolve as a human being moving forward? Yeah. But that doesn't mean there isn't baggage to carry in the years to come. Yeah.
So when did you decide that you didn't want to be a soldier anymore?
Probably before I signed my second contract. So I ended up signing a second contract going from Fort Drum in New York with the 10th Mountain Division. That's where I went with to Bosnia. Then I went to Fort Lewis, Washington with a second ID and went to Iraq.
Before you went to Iraq, you were already having second thoughts?
Absolutely. I think everyone should weigh what they're about to do, especially when it's something momentous like going to war. Standing on the tarmac, I'm sure each individual person as they're about to board a plane must have had, you know, conflict, hopefully conflict in their minds at some point. Wondering, is this the right thing to do? Am I doing the right thing? That kind of. But for me, I thought it might be, the war in Iraq might be illegal. I'm not an international lawyer, but I had talked to, the night before, actually, my mother contacted me because during the Vietnam War, part of our family split off and went to Australia. They live in Perth now. And she had offered a ticket for me to fly there and join them. The veterans in my family, I'd already talked to some of them, and they had already expressed that they would support me if I didn't go and I went to, because I wasn't going to leave the country. If I was going to stand up and say, no, I think this is wrong, that they would support me if I was sent into military prison. But I didn't end up going. I was at West Point, and I talked to the cadets there, and I challenged them to say, why do you think I went? What would you tell me that would get me on that plane? And what it ended up being was the soldier to my left and right, people like Bosch and Firillo and Joukowsky and others. Though over the years, I wonder if that was the right decision, because as much as I cared about those people, you know, good people, why didn't I also think about people whose names I couldn't pronounce, whose doors I was going to kick in the early mornings of the hours of the day, and whose lives I was going to change?
Were you a writer before you became a soldier? Like, you were writing when you were over there?
Yeah, I think my teens, I would take it back to there when I was in a band. I started writing poems and lyrics for the band, and that led into stories, et cetera. So I, you know, the through line of my life is the life of a writer. And I've been a machinist, low-voltage electrician, a soldier, a teacher. I'm a director of a creative writing program now in Lake Tahoe. So I live here in Orlando, but my job is in Lake Tahoe. And through all of those, through my work life, writing is the undercurrent, the thread that ties them all together.
Did it help you deal with what you saw and what you experienced in Iraq?
No. You know, especially you think poetry that's supposed to get people, it's all about feelings and getting things off your chest. But I think that's a common misperception about poetry. And the reason I wrote poetry is because there seemed to be a lack of narrative. The narrative was the year of boredom. But in terms of things happening, there would just be the punctuation of intense events, but they didn't tie together very well. You know, when we're down inside of history, it's hard to find the through lines and the things that tie together to see a sweeping movement or a moment that's happening in a large way that say a colonel or a general might when they're looking at political movements on a map. But when you're down inside the history like I was, it was hard to find it. So what would happen is one of those events would happen, a car bomb or a woman crying by the side of the road, or there was a dead infant that I heard being reported over the radio that I saw. As we were driving through the orange groves north of Baghdad, I remember seeing a man and a woman, very somber. They were walking on the side of the road towards where the dead infant had been reported. He was carrying a shovel, and she had a blanket in her arms with no baby in it. And just these very quiet moments. And so poetry was a vehicle that can sort of contain or try to explore moments like that. The trouble for me was that when I came back home, I had these notebooks filled with poems. I had a book of poems that was about to be published. I didn't know that, but you know, that's what was in my hands. But once I typed them up, then they become a larger whole as you put them together. Like poem after poem, it starts to build a larger kind of narrative. And yet I couldn't grasp a narrative. I couldn't, and it's another way of saying, you know, I'm talking about art right now, but what I'm really saying is like, I couldn't figure out what had happened in my life. There's all these disparate events, and what do they mean? What's the storyline of my own life? You know, what am I learning from this journey? It's taken me a long time to start to figure some of those things out.
You're a fairly recent arrival, Brian Turner, to Orlando. You came here in 2009.
Right.
What do you make of the literary scene here?
It's pretty phenomenal, actually. You know, part of my introduction is, and I recommend it to anyone, the house is open, is the Kerouac House. And the Kerouac Project of Orlando, anyone can look it up online. But the, you know, Valencia College, I just read as part of a literary festival that they had, different campuses. You know, Rollins College has a great series of events. Functionally Literate Radio does some podcasts that are pretty cool.
It's the Borough Press.
Right, Borough Press with Ryan Reeves and Jared Sylvia is doing some great work. Billy Collins is here in town, you know, former poet laureate. I don't know if you just stay poet laureate or you know how that works, but I was surprised in a similar way to like, I was surprised as on the musician side of my life. I found that Orlando is chock full of jazz musicians. And when I tell people around the country, I always see this surprised look on people's faces. They just think Disney, you know, giant figures of Mickey Mouse sort of stomping and hovering over all of us here. But there's an active jazz scene. And in a similar way, there's a really strong writing scene here, which is great for me because I come from the Central Valley where there's also a very strong literary scene in California. But around the country, there's just sort of pockets. There are a few. There's one in Brattleboro, Vermont, Seattle, Boston, you know, a few places around the country, Austin, Texas, and here, you know. We're really lucky here, although sometimes it doesn't seem like it. You just have to kind of put your ear out to the ground and you'll see that there's a lot going on.
What's your advice to a young writer? What do you tell them?
The classic advice is to read and read a lot. Of course, I recommend being voracious in the reading, but my biggest thing is just to go out and live a life. I remember being in Ireland and I was in a pub and it was up in north in Donegal and there was a band playing. There was a guy playing and he had a dog curled up at his feet and a couple other people joined in a session. His daughters were doing this dance that they'd learned. And there were two Americans, obviously, up against the wall, sort of wallflowering. They each had their notebooks out and they were taking notes like anthropologists, you know. And I kind of felt like, I get it, you know, I'm a writer too and I'm taking notes like all the time. But at the same time, I felt like, you know, get up and dance, you know, have a drink if you want or a Coke or whatever, you know, but like live. And then when you're confused by things or things are surprising to you, whether it's by beauty or by pain, try to see what the imagination can find on the page about it. But I don't take the anthropologist approach, although I do recommend people get out into the world. Like they were almost there. You know, they were in the right place, but they just hadn't quite fully got into it. People need to dance. They need to get the blues. If you're going to play the blues, you got to earn them.
Brian Turner is an award-winning poet. He's formerly an infantry team leader in the United States Army in Iraq. He now lives in Orlando. Brian Turner, thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, it's an honor. Thank you.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. Still to come, Orlando's comic book culture and young adult fiction. Intersection returns in a minute. You're listening to Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Continuing our exploration of Central Florida's literary scene and turning now to comic books. For some, comics are what you find in the funny pages of a newspaper, but more than just the 3 or 4 panel gag of a Blondie or a Garfield or a Peanuts comic strip, comic art also spans graphic novels, and it's also spawned a slew of blockbuster movies based on Marvel superheroes. We're here to talk about the nearly billion-dollar comic book industry as Julian Chambliss. He's a professor of history at Rollins. He specializes in urban development, culture, and comic books. Julian, welcome to Intersection.
Thanks for having me, Matthew. I appreciate it.
So you said in an interview, you talked about the comic book industry, and you described it as a niche industry, in an industry that's already niche. What did you mean by that?
Well, when we talk about comic books, at least the comic books in sort of the popular American mind, we're talking about industry that's about, you know, 85 years old, 90 years old. That particular comic book industry is usually associated with juvenile readers. The superhero is the genre that dominates that comic book marketplace. And that was a very big and wide-selling industry, selling something like 100 million copies in the 1940s. But now it doesn't sell nearly that much, but arguably is more profitable because the comics cost more now, of course.
Do you have people, the writers, the artists, taking more time and more care in their craft?
Of course, yes. I think modern comic books are incredibly accomplished artistic forms with writers and artists that see it as a legitimate art form, which it was not in its early days. At some odd level, in the heyday of comics in terms of the number of people buying and reading them, the people who were producing them thought of them as a stepping stone to something a little bit more legitimate. Mm-hmm. Over the years, of course, that's changed, and people want to grow up to be comic artists. And in fact, you know, this semester I'm teaching a class at Rollins called Creating the Comic Book City, and we talk a lot about artists and their artistic journey, and at some level, the search for legitimacy that they were looking for in the past, but actually now, if you're a comic book artist, you kind of have.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is, you know, a cachet now, as you say, with some forms of the comic book industry, like you've got sophisticated graphic novels, the Watchmen series, Alan Moore. Are comics viewed with more respect now than they might have been, say, in the 1940s or 50s?
Yeah, in the 1940s and 50s, comic books were deeply suspect, although very popular, right? Mm-hmm. Comic book publisher like DC Comics had to actually haul out an editorial board and put respectable people on it to prove that they were respectful and good for kids. And now, I think those questions aren't really pressing in that way, right? So now we assume quite rightly that kids don't really read comics. It's really a sort of adult readership. And as a consequence, the themes in comics often are adult. That doesn't mean there aren't comics for kids. There are. But as you mentioned, Watchmen, which was a series done by Alan Moore in the 80s, which it was bound up in and really sort of created what we think of as the modern graphic novel marketplace, is voted one of the 100 most important novels of the 20th century.
Julian Chambliss, what about the movies that we see now, like The Avengers, Captain America, Thor, Iron Man? What impact has that had back on the comic book scene?
I think it's had a lot of impact. I think when we think about those movies in particular, those are produced by Marvel Studios, which is one of the parts of Marvel Entertainment. So the publishing company and the movie company are in dialogue, but not necessarily in coordination, if that makes sense. So if you read the comic books, they often make changes that really do harken back to the things people know from the movies in the effort to capture people. Well, if you liked Iron Man, check out Iron Man, and it looks and feels a lot like what you saw in the movie. If you like the Avengers, those are the Avengers that you'll find in the comic book. But the stories are still the comic book stories, right? They're still within their own continuity, but the look and feel really does mirror how the movies are, to the point where Iron Man, Tony Stark, really loves look and sound like Robert Downey Jr. now. He's had such an indelible impact on the character. And you see that a lot with Marvel because they are a part of the same union and they do have a lot of dialogue. There's a creative committee that's very active that has Marvel publishing people on it that look at the films and give input. And so they have a kind of a shared narrative template that they're aware of and they try to reference, I think.
Are some people seeing you know, their first view of a character like Iron Man or like Thor might be on the big screen rather than a comic book. And I'm wondering if that's kind of alienated some of the diehard comic book fans.
Yeah, that in fact is exactly what happens, right? And a lot of kids don't know comic books at all. They know games or movies. With Iron Man, especially, it's the movies. So they know the movies very well. They don't know the comic that well. With a character like Batman, it has a whole sort of like ecosystem of games and like the Arkham Asylum games. That is what most people know. And they don't have a lot of deep background in terms of the comic history, which, you know, is, as I say, like 75, 80 years for some of these characters. And so for diehard comic fans, yeah, it is a little alienating. And that, I think, sparks some of the controversies you see online between new fans and old fans over their sort of knowledge base, their right to be sort of in that space. That's triggered some really unfortunate instances of bullying and sort of like confrontation and harassment. Because, of course, one of the things that's a consequence of this sort of media penetration is a broader audience that is more diverse, more women, really at some level, the fastest growing element of the comic book marketplace is women readers and women creators getting involved, and that penetrating into all areas and creating like this kind of dissidence in the minds of like really older, more established readers. Some of them, not all of them, clearly. Mm-hmm. I think we usually are talking about a kind of vocal minority that's reacting badly and should recognize that the vast majority of comic fans are always happy when people discover a hobby that they love.
What about what's going on here in Central Florida? You've got conventions like MegaCon in Orlando. You've got big comic book stores like Acme and Longwood. What does that tell you about the comic book landscape here in Central Florida?
No question. I think when we think about the comic book landscape in Central Florida, we should recognize that it is as complex as the comic book world and the comic book culture itself. So if you think about it, you can find examples that really align with the broader comic culture. So you look at a graphic novel like The Parish that came out. It was produced by a small press here, which is a sort of like autobiographical story of an AmeriCorps worker working in post-Katrina New Orleans. It is a small press, and they do prose, but they also do comics. And this was a graphic novel that they published, and so you can buy it on their website. So it's called The Parish.
Where's the creative team for that from?
I think the artist and the writer are based here. I'm not exactly sure, but I know that they were here at least for the period that they were putting it together. And then you have superhero comics. People might not know it, but Gallant Comics, which is a publisher that puts out public domain heroes reimagined for a contemporary period. So they have a comic book called Amazing Man, which is based on a classic character that was invented in like 1941. It's in the public domain. They've also taken a lot of characters created by Jack Kirby and incorporated them into this Amazing Man story. So they're reimagining some of these characters created in the late 30s, early 40s. They're in the public domain and telling them with new stories. And again, they have a Kickstarter that just finished, and you can pick up the first 6 issues, I think, of Amazing Man. If you look for Gallant Comics online, you'll be able to find that. And of course, you have a longtime sort of comic publisher, Students of the Unusual, which has been, I think, publishing in Orlando for years now. They're always at the Indie Expo, at their MegaCon, and that's a publisher. They put out a whole line of books. So if you look for them, Students of the Unusual, you can find them online. And they have a sort of like adult, more Comics X with the Comics X, which is a reference to the underground comic movement that emerged in the 1970s, more adult themes, a lot more cutting social satire. I think they're more aligned with that kind of knowledge, not comics for kids per se, but comics for adults looking for a kind of horror or comedy or something like that. And then, of course, you know, when you talk about the comic book landscape, there's a lot of like comic books as intersections of prose work and comics work. So Jesse Bradley, who lives in Orlando, had a comic book that was based on his poems that was put out by, I think, Yes Yes Books. And my colleague, Vidhu Agarwal at Rollins, she too has a book of poems coming out that has a big component of like visuals, a little of artistic stuff in it. Trouble with Humpador is the name of her book, and it's going to be published this coming year.
Is there a comic for Florida Man? Does Florida Man have a life?
Florida Man does not yet have a comic, but now that you put it out into the universe, I expect that we'll see a Florida Man comic. There are some projects. I mean, I actually worked on a project with my colleague, Rachel Simmons, called Future Bear, which is a comic book story about a bear from the future who comes back in time to try to help us mitigate climate change. She does the art for Future Bear, and I write the story. And so our first issue is out, and it's an installation. But you can check it out at futurebear.net. And we've been doing a lot with kids, trying to educate them about environmental sustainability. But the story takes place in Florida.
Are there any artists or comic book writers who spring to mind who really conjure up something that's uniquely Floridian?
I mean, there's been some really impressive creators that have come out of Central Florida, like Joshua Falkoff, who's a great comic book writer, wrote for Valiant. He went to UCF. Phil Noto, who doesn't live here anymore but did live here a long time, was a great comic book artist. You've seen his work on Superman, Supergirl. You know, if you want to find out more, I think one of the things that you can do is you can check out some of the comic book meetups that are happening in Central Florida. That you have a great meetup that happens at the Geek Easy and the Comic Shop. You can go to the Acme in Longwood. I know that they have a lot of like events there. They have Nerd Night with multiple Nerd Nights. That's a great place to meet people interested in comics. And there are online things like insidecomicbooks.com. as a young guy who blogs about comics. He's very active on the blogosphere, on Twitter, really connecting with comic book artists. Flame On, which is a nerdy podcast where they talk about comics. It's an all-gay sort of like review show. And of course, you can always go to a comic shop and they always have like signings, right? They bring in people, artists, writers, and they do signings at a comic shop. So there's always interesting stuff happening. And of course, Coliseum of Comics does the same thing. You know, Free Comic Book Day in May, first weekend in May. It's a great time to go out and see what's available for all ages in terms of comics. So there's always something going on in terms of comics in Central Florida. It's a complicated landscape because I think there's more of a comic culture. Now, when we talk about comics, we should think about it in terms of like a range, and it's a comic culture. On the one end, it may be the stuff that you know and that you see in movies like an Iron Man and superheroes, but on the other end of these deeply personal stories that might be autobiographical graphic novels or artistic endeavors inspired by anime. So there's a huge zine culture in Orlando. They had a zine fest this summer, and some of those were really sort of illustrated, right? They were drawn. They were inspired by Japanese or French comics and people blending poetry and sort of imagery with art and creating like these sort of unique publications.
How do you see this comic book landscape in Central Florida changing in the next decade or so?
I think one of the things that will be really interesting is if we'll see some of the elements of success associated with UCF and its animation program. Is that going to spill over into people pursuing not just simply game design and sort of independent games, but also comics, a kind of multi-tier, multi-arena approach? I went to the San Diego Comic-Con a couple of years ago, and that was one of the things that really sort of stuck out to me because some of the small comic book publishers, they really thought of themselves as IP managers, right? Like they have a stable of characters and they were pushing them into every definable area. Like, so I have these characters. I'm going to make an animated cartoon. I'm going to make a game. I'm going to have a comic book. I'm going to have merchandise. And, you know, these were people who banded together to create a studio and they put out these books. And they literally thought of the managing the IP that way. And so when you talk about the sort of creative landscape around a place like UCF, which has a very well-known game design, increasingly I suspect you'll start to see that kind of thing happen too, because the audience that loves games is also an audience that loves comics, so it's another revenue stream.
Julian Chambliss is a professor of history at Rollins, specializing in urban development, culture, and comic books. Julian, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks a lot, man.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're exploring Central Florida's literary scene. Up next, librarian and author Lauren Jaboldi-Mather shares with us what teens are reading and how series like The Hunger Games are supercharging the young adult genre. That's when Intersection returns. You're listening to Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The young adult fiction genre has come a long way since the days of Judy Blume and R.L. Stein. Here to talk more about this evolving genre of fiction geared towards teens is Lauren Jaboldi-Mather. She's a librarian for the Orange County Library System and a young adult fiction author. Her book, The Night We Said Yes, came out this summer. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So what is it that young adults are reading these days?
They're reading a lot of things. The whatever was made into a movie is still extremely popular, like Hunger Games, Divergent, Maze Runner, If I Stay, Fault in Our Stars. Those are huge. Those are most frequently checked out of the library. But there's also smaller books that are being pushed. Fantasy is a huge genre right now for them. I guess, I don't know if it's influence of Game of Thrones, but everyone loves that. Red Queen was a big debut this year, same with Ember in the Ashes. Those are very, very popular, and they're just kind of fun. Fairy tale retellings are very big. It started with Cinder a few years ago. That was a required reading book. And
so that's a version of Cinderella?
Cinderella. It's yeah, it's Cyborg Cinderella. it's a big series. It's still going. It goes with a different – there's Scarlet, that's Little Red, and all of that. So that's still big. Paranormal's kind of dropped off since the days of Twilight, but that's still being read every now and then. But dystopian is huge. But I think another big thing that teens really like are the realistic stuff that might not be talked about in school, but they're going through themselves. So those I kind of consider at the library your cult classic books, like 13 Reasons Why, which is about suicide. That one's always requested and always checked out. Perks of Being a Wallflower. Crank.
That was made into a movie.
Made into
too,
a movie
right?
as well. Yep. Mm-hmm. Very, very popular amongst teens. Crank, which is drug abuse. and then even Fault in Our Stars, which is you know, cancer and stuff. Not that every teen is going through that, but the kind of the empathetic read of it.
Right. And is it John Green?
John Green. He's huge.
And he's from Orlando, right?
Yeah. He lived in the Baldwin area, I believe. Mm-hmm. And his book, Paper Towns, which was just made into a movie, takes place in here. So it has like driving around Winter Park and going downtown, which is kind of cool to read.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, having somebody who's so well known mm-hmm. from Orlando.
Yeah, it's awesome. I have a teen group at my library. It's based off of kind of his online collective called Nerdfighters, and they all kind of come together and talk about books and Harry Potter and stuff like that. They're wonderful, and they love that they kind of hold John Green as this role model, because he's gone and made amazing books, and he's from here, so it kind of like shows them that they can do it too.
Mm-hmm. So the books you just reference there, that list you're talking about, I mean, mm-hmm. is this things that young adults are reading for pleasure, or is it part of their curriculum?
For fun, mostly. A lot of those books are not taught, definitely, but it's for fun. It's a lot of, what you know, word of mouth, really popular on Tumblr, get passed around. Like I said, some of them are cult classics where they just kind of push them off to each other. The required reading of YA, there's the Florida Teen Reads List, which is published every year. It's voted on by a committee of librarians and teachers. And that is usually required reading for high school English classes over the summer for general. So we see a huge amount of teens coming in and requesting these books. And it's usually a variety of genres within it. So it can be anywhere from a romance young adult book to nonfiction to sci-fi, fantasy, everything. So they try to kind of hit all of those. So, and kind of seeing how they're requested at the library and how many requests some still have, you can see which ones are more popular than others.
Mm-hmm.
So that's always fun, and kind of and it's fun as a librarian specifically, kind of like talking to the teen and picking which one might work best for them, because I try to read them too.
How are they reading them? Are they reading them on their digital e-readers, or are they reading them in actual book form?
Funny you should mention that. Book form is most popular. We have ebooks of all of them, and we also have audiobooks of them, and usually they always want the book form. We offer the others as well, just in case they have shorter hold lists or they're actually checked in, and sometimes they'll take the ebook because, you know, you can read it on your phone, but mm-hmm. for the most part, they always want the book, which is interesting because, you know, there's that whole books are dying, ebook revolution, but kids, I've noticed, and teens are still kind of holding on to books.
Do they tell you why?
No, I know, like, the teens I work with, they really like just kind of holding it. They're, you know, they're the ones who read for fun. They mm-hmm. kind of like that whole looking at it and holding it. And I don't know. I think maybe they don't trust themselves to read if they're looking at, like, a phone. They could just go on Tumblr or whatever. But for the most part, they definitely want the books.
Mm-hmm. What about the classics, Catcher in the Rye, things like that? Do you kids still reading these?
Yeah, they're still required in school, a lot of them. I was just kind of looking at that this morning. A lot of lists still include 1984, Great Gatsby, Kill a Mockingbird, all of those classics. And I think it's different where I've learned from working with teens that they like them later on more so. And even myself, I like them later on when it's not required, so to say. Mm-hmm. Great Gatsby's always been one that they're more okay with because it's a fun story. It's, you know, Kill a Mockingbird, they always like as well, for the most part. But a lot of the ones that are being pushed and taught, they don't care for as much. But I've seen a lot of teachers do, which is kind of cool, is using young adult novels and classics together to kind of pair them and make them, you know, here's the new relatable version and here's the classic. And I think the teens are enjoying the classics a lot more when they can kind of see it in a modern setting and then read the classic and get it,
mm-hmm.
which is neat. I think that's a really cool way to teach it.
You're a young adult author yourself, a YA writer. What are some of the challenges of writing for this age group?
You want to be authentic. When you're writing YA, you don't want to write for people your age. Because, I mean, I could think about when I was a teen and I didn't have a cell phone. And you have to incorporate stuff like that. You have to incorporate the issues of social media and what they're feeling. And you don't want to sound like you're teaching them a moral. You want the story to have, like, hope, obviously. And you want it to be relatable, but you don't want to talk to them like they're children, because they're not. They know a lot more. They're smart teenagers. So I think that's it. You want to make it as real as possible. And for me personally, I want to make the teens at the library proud, because I know them. So
mm-hmm. You talked about some of the books which have been made into movies, like the
Fault in Our Stars, Hunger Games.
Yeah, the Hunger Games. I mean, those have, I imagine, driven some people back to those books, and it would be, you know, people have seen, they're adults, they've seen the movie, they want to read the book.
Yeah, we get adults, we get all ages coming for it. We get little kids coming in for stuff for like Hunger Games, and I have to be like, well, you're 7, I don't think you should be reading this. But yeah, adults are all over it as well. A lot of people come in with just, like, if they saw the movie Maze Runner, they'll come in just for Scorch Trials to go for the second one. But the movies have really, really pushed the popularity of these books. When Hunger Games, for instance, was big, when the first movie came up, we had massive amounts of holds on it. We carried probably over 100 copies and still had like 300 holds on it. Mm-hmm. So we had to keep replenishing that.
What's your sense as a librarian of the popularity of the genre? Are we on a kind of cresting a wave now? Is this increasing in popularity?
Yeah, it's very highly popular, very, very popular. I don't know if it's like an apex or anything, but it's because, like I said, adults are reading it quite a bit. College kids are reading it. Everyone is. So it's really, looking at the circulation that we have at my branch is Alafaya, but Alafaya specifically, it's one of our biggest departments and is also one of our more circulated. So it is kind of interesting and fun to see this.
Do you know, are there a lot of authors who've made a switch from writing fiction for adults to saying, hey, I can write young adult fiction too?
Yes, there's a lot. Brandon Sanderson is a sci-fi author. He does YA now as well. There's a bunch of mystery authors. Patterson has YA books as well as kids books. There's a bunch. It's because it is such a huge wave right now. There are a lot that are kind of jumping over, which is interesting to kind of see the two views.
Lauren Giboldi-Maffa is a librarian for Orange County Library System. She's a young adult fiction author as well. Her book, The Night We Said Yes, came out this summer. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Support for Intersection comes from our listeners and from Florida Hospital. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Join us again Friday morning at 9. We're taking your calls on the weekly news roundtable. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.